Today's International Edition. Coming up, historic Iran nuclear agreement reached. President Obama praises the deal, others don't like it.
When this deal expires in 15 years on the plutonium track, and they're again permitted to build heavy water reactors, they'll have all the infrastructure in place to pick up where they left off, except by that time they'll be an economically resurgent powerhouse.
Still another bailout battle ahead for Greece's prime minister. A Jamaican singer hits number one. We'll give it a listen. What that's all about. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. World powers have reached a deal with Iran that will limit the country's nuclear program in exchange for East economic sanctions, ending more than a decade of tempestuous negotiations. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who spearheaded recent efforts by the P5 plus one countries to broker an accord, told a PAC news conference in Vienna Tuesday, "This is the good deal we had sought." President Obama announced the agreement to the American people in an early morning address from the White House.
"Today, because America negotiated from a position of strength and principle, we have stopped the spread of nuclear weapons in this region. Because of this deal, the international community will be able to verify that the Islamic Republic of Iran will not develop a nuclear weapon."
The deal will limit Iran's potential development of nuclear weapons while allowing the country to maintain a civilian atomic program and, according to senior U.S. administration officials, dramatically scale back the number of Tehran's advanced centrifuges by two-thirds. The agreement will also require oversight by the U.N. Nuclear Agency. Iran's always insisted that its nuclear ambitions are aimed at the peaceful production of nuclear energy. One of the ways Iran hopes to produce that energy is through a plutonium reactor that it's built in the region of Arak. Joseph Cerencioni is the head of the Plowshares Fund, a U.S.-based group that advocates for nonproliferation.
"Under this deal, Iran has agreed to take out that reactor core, export it out of the country, reconfigure it so it will make a fraction of the plutonium, less than 1 kilogram, and further that it promises that all the fuel, once it comes out of that reactor, will actually be shipped out of the country, and it will never, never construct a reprocessing facility, a plant that could allow it to extract plutonium from any fuel." So this is quite sweeping in it, the way it blocks the plutonium path to a bomb.
Joseph Cerencioni, head of the Plowshares Fund, a U.S.-based group advocating for nuclear nonproliferation. Daryl Kimball is director of the Arms Control Association in Washington. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with him about his reaction to the deal and the inspection program the agreement sets up.
"I think this is a very strong, balanced agreement that meets the bottom lines of both sides. At the fundamental level, it restricts Iran's uranium enrichment program, its stockpiles, its potential pathway to produce plutonium in such a way that Iran is at least 12 months away from amassing enough material for a bomb. And there is a very robust IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, inspection system, the likes of which we have not seen before. It will also clarify and resolve questions that have been lingering about past Iranian activities regarding experiments involving research that could be used to make nuclear weapons. All these things have to be achieved by Iran before sanctions are lifted, incentives for Iran to follow through. So I think this is a very strong win-win agreement for both sides that should hold up over the test of time."
Secretary of State John Kerry, in his remarks in Vienna, said no part of this agreement relies on trust. He's made it clear that if Iran fails to comply, the sanctions will be reimposed. Now, this means intrusive inspections. I have to hearken back to the Iraq days when David Kaye was a weapons inspector and would literally barge into facilities. Do you think that we're going to see David Kaye-type inspections with Iran under this agreement?
Iraq was a defeated country. The inspection program there was different. This is an inspection program over a known nuclear program. It's also designed to prevent an unknown secret program. The IAEA will have many tools in its arsenal. They're going to have information, real-time monitoring, inspections across all of Iran's nuclear facilities and across their nuclear fuel cycle, from uranium mining to producing centrifuges to the enrichment of uranium that will be allowed. And they have the opportunity for short notice on-site inspections, including inspections of military sites, if the IAEA has information that they're engaged in an activity they're not supposed to be engaged in. That will be managed access. What's also important is there is an adjudication commission designed to resolve any disputes that might arise, and it specifies that those disputes have to be resolved within 30 days, or else the complaining party, maybe the U.S. or France, has a right to consider the lack of access a violation of the agreement. So that is a new and novel component. I think it gives the U.S. and others should give us a great deal of confidence that Iran cannot get away with any significant noncompliance.
Darrell Kimball, director of the Arms Control Association in Washington, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Some observers are sharply critical of the deal. Among them, Omri Sirin of the pro-Israel group, the Israel Project, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to inform the media about Israel-related issues. International Edition's Michael Lippin asked him whether Iran could still have a plutonium path to a bomb.
Well, of course it could. The deal allows Iran to keep its heavy water infrastructure in place despite UN resolutions that had called on it to cease heavy water work. So the original idea was that you would force them to make Arak into a light water reactor. Because they'll be allowed to keep their heavy water infrastructure intact, when this deal expires in 15 years on the plutonium track and they're again permitted to build heavy water reactors, they'll have all the infrastructure in place to pick up where they left off, except by that time they'll be an economically resurgent powerhouse.
I've also heard that Iran has developed so much nuclear know-how and expertise that there's no deal on earth that could get Iran to unlearn what it's already learned. So don't we just have to live with a nuclear-capable Iran?
A terrible argument, Michael. The idea that nuclear know-how can't be bombed may be true, but nuclear know-how can certainly be suffocated. Nuclear scientists need places to work. They need jobs. They need places to keep up their skills. If we would have forced the Iranians to dismantle their nuclear infrastructure, then their nuclear scientists would have had nothing to do and would have transitioned out of that industry very, very quickly. The idea that you can't bomb away nuclear knowledge, it's like saying that you can't bomb away an auto sector. Okay, but if you shut down the auto sector, then auto workers have nothing to do.
Well, supporters of the deal also say it's much better to deny Iran a nuclear weapons capability for at least the next few years than to not do so, because the Middle East is already full of so many conflicts that it just doesn't need another one right now. Doesn't that seem reasonable?
That's a deeply dishonest argument. This deal fuels wars in two separate ways. The first is it drops the conventional arms embargo against Iran. It does so in 5 years, but Iran's neighbors won't wait for it to stockpile the strategic ballistic missiles that it will now be able to buy. They'll immediately move to get ahead of the curve. And the same thing is true, Michael, in a nuclear context. You know, the Saudis have told us, in as many words, that they won't wait for Iran to get a nuclear weapon, that they will act when they believe that it's inevitable that Iran will get a nuclear weapon. And as we know, as the president has admitted on NPR, this plan sunsets in 13, 14, 15 years, at which point Iran will be allowed to have a zero breakout capability, which means there'll be a screw's turn away from a nuclear weapon. This deal will incentivize every actor in the region to stockpile conventional weapons and incentivize at least a couple of them, the Saudis and the Turks, to acquire their own nuclear capabilities. It fuels wars.
Well, you know, another key selling point of the deal from the point of view of the authors is that there isn't any other realistic alternative short of the U.S. going to war with Iran. What might you consider to be, you know, a realistic alternative?
Well, first of all, let's get something out of the way right at the beginning. The idea that there's no alternative is not an excuse for the president's banned deal. It's a result of diplomacy that didn't create alternatives. Now, of course, if you shred the sanctions regime like this administration has done, and you take away economic tools like this administration has done, then suddenly you can look up and say there are no other options because you took away all the other options. Coercive diplomacy, supporting America's allies, if necessary, negotiating with the Iranians as we've done over the past 2 years, with a little bit of push me, pull you, a little bit of us giving the money, a little bit of them not pushing the envelope on nukes, would have been a far better alternative. And in any case, this deal is worse than no deal. It is a deal that provides Iran with conventional weapons. It's a deal that provides Iran with nuclear weapons. It's a deal that provides Iran with the money in order to pursue both of them, $150 billion. And, you know, you don't need an excuse not to do something bad. This deal is a terrible deal.
Omri Sirin, head of press and strategy for the Israel Project, speaking from Vienna with International Edition's Michael Lippin. The Iran nuclear deal will soon be presented to the U.S. Congress, where President Obama could have a tough time persuading his Republican critics to support it. My colleague Susan Yaki asked our congressional correspondent Michael Bowman what happens next.
There will be 2 months of consideration of congressional deliberations, and we expect weeks of hearings and Obama administration officials going to Capitol Hill to testify on this very subject. Congress gave itself a 2-month period to review any deal that might emerge with Iran and the ability to vote up or down, yes or no, majority votes in both houses of this Republican-controlled legislature. President Obama would have the ability, should Congress vote against the deal, to veto it. And then Republicans would need significant numbers of Democrats to join with them in opposition if they were to try to override a presidential veto.
What is the sentiment up there already about the pact?
That depends on who you ask. I spent a couple of hours in the halls of Congress speaking with various lawmakers. Republicans are significantly more skeptical. In fact, some are openly hostile to this pact. Democrats seem to be taking a more measured response. There is very little cheering going on, but Democrats at least seem to be willing to look at the deal, to review it, and their initial impressions seem to be much more favorable. But there is definitely a divergent view on Capitol Hill, depending on who you speak with and the party to which they belong.
That was VOA's Michael Bowman speaking with International Edition's Susan Yaki. The Iran nuclear agreement process is expected to move next week to New York, where the UN Security Council will adopt a resolution lifting all international sanctions related to the country's nuclear program. But a UN arms embargo will remain in place for 5 years, and one on ballistic missiles will continue for 8 years. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, says the United States will submit a draft Security Council resolution in the coming days on behalf of the five powers, Germany and the European Union. Oil markets reacted to news of the Iran nuclear deal. Business correspondent Alexis Christophers in New York spoke earlier with International Edition's Michael Lippin.
We did see oil prices stabilize and then actually move higher as the trading day went on. And that's really because this deal between Iran and six world powers was anticipated. So these were some traders coming back in and seeing this as a buying opportunity. Analysts say the expected rise in global supply has been priced into the market, and they don't expect Iranian oil to hit the marketplace until the end of this year.
What are observers of the oil market saying about the possibility of other oil producers in the region cutting their production in anticipation of a rise in the Iranian exports?
I'm not hearing that so much as I am hearing that perhaps we're going to see a price war amongst the oil-producing nations. I spoke to one analyst who believes we're going to see oil hit $40 a barrel by the end of the year.
Some other big news today, potentially a Chinese takeover bid for a U.S. chip maker that would be a very big deal indeed. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. If this deal were to happen, it would be the largest takeover of an American company by a Chinese one, Tsinghua Unigroup. We're getting reports that it is preparing to bid $23 billion for Micron Technology, which is one of the largest memory chip makers in the U.S. Neither side is confirming that there is a bid in the works. Some analysts are saying this deal is highly unlikely to get past U.S. regulators, who are really increasingly viewing semiconductors as a strategic industry. Micron is really the last major maker in the U.S. of chips.
Can you give us a quick update on Starbucks and its latest expansion plans?
Yeah, well, pretty soon Africans will be able to order a cup of Starbucks coffee. Starbucks has inked a deal with a franchisor called Taste Holdings in Johannesburg. The first stores will open early next year. And this deal means Starbucks can now sell coffee for the first time in some of the places where it sources it.
Alexis Christophorus in New York talking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. Social media is filled with reaction to the Iran nuclear agreement. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to tell us what people are saying about it on the web.
Hi, Ray. I'm going to focus on what the presidential hopefuls are saying about the agreement on Twitter. Beginning with the Republican side, let's take a look at Marco Rubio's account. He tweeted 10 times on the nuclear deal Tuesday. He wrote in one of the tweets that President Obama has consistently negotiated from a position of weakness, giving concessions to a regime that has American blood on its hands. He even shared Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's tweet, who argued the world is a much more dangerous place today than it was yesterday.
I guess that's more or less the position of other Republican candidates. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. The latest Republican to join the presidential race, Scott Walker, has also been quite prolific on this issue, and Jeb Bush didn't mince his words at all. He tweeted, "The nuclear agreement with Iran is a dangerous, deeply flawed, and short-sighted deal."
Well, pretty strong words there. Uh-huh. What about the leading Republican candidate, Donald Trump?
Well, he hasn't tweeted anything about this issue, which is, you know, quite surprising given how vocal he is usually. And guess who else has been quiet?
Well, I'll take a guess. A leading Democrat?
Exactly. Hillary Clinton wasn't tweeting at all on Tuesday on this subject, but she has said in the past that she views the Iran nuclear deal as an important step. As for Bernie Sanders, he tweeted, "The Iran deal is a victory for diplomacy over saber-rattling and could keep us from being drawn into another never-ending war." Ray, you can see the divide between the two parties on the nuclear deal is crystal clear.
Thanks a lot for the wrap-up, G. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition in Washington. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras faces a battle to secure parliamentary backing for the bailout deal worked out with the European Union. Several lawmakers are vowing to oppose the demands for more austerity. There have also been some protests on the streets of Athens. Henry Ridgewell has more.
Long lines still snake from ATM machines. The banks remain closed and close to collapse, and the 60 euro limit on withdrawals is still in place. Greece may have a bailout deal, but little has changed on the streets. And it's clear that under the deal, the hardship will go on. Many blame Germany for demanding more austerity. They are so inhumane, says this woman. They take no consideration of other people's lives, those who have reached an impasse, those who have committed suicide, children who are hungry. Others are turning on Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras and his Syriza party, which was elected on a promise of ending austerity. One protester set fire to a Syriza flag outside Parliament. The deal demands pension cuts, tax hikes, and the sell-off of 50 billion euros worth of public sector assets. Greek lawmakers have until the end of Wednesday to vote on the proposals. Several have pledged to oppose elements of the agreement, including the head of Syriza's coalition partner, the Independent Greeks Party, Panos Kamenos. Mr. Kamenos said, "We will not permit for this game to go on when, in a democracy and the country where democracy was born, the people do not decide, but some unelected official from Berlin decides." Prime Minister Tsipras could also struggle to sell the deal to the Greek people, who voted emphatically against further EU-led austerity in a referendum earlier this month. John Springford of Policy Group, the Centre for European Reform.
It just repeats what was done before. And what happened before was that austerity killed growth and it raised unemployment. And it damaged the legitimacy of the economic reforms which the creditors insisted upon.
Germany ruled out any so-called haircut or reduction on the amount Athens owes its creditors.
The German taxpayer does not want to be on the hook for Greece. And it will be very difficult for Merkel, with the domestic pressures that she faces, to climb down on that. So I think that Brexit is still very much on the table.
Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund said Tuesday Greece had missed a second payment and is now $2.2 billion in arrears. Greece owes the European Central Bank $3.85 billion by July 20th. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Over 350 million people worldwide suffer from hearing loss, but a new app called YouSound can turn a smartphone into a digital hearing tool, and it optimizes a smartphone's audio output to an individual's personal hearing needs. Users like Julio Fernandez say it helps them reconnect with the world.
I had totally and completely isolated myself from society. I wouldn't go out with friends. I wouldn't go out and see them.
The YouSound app enables a smartphone to capture conversations in real time and compensates the sound or recorded audio for the user, just like a hearing aid. Dr. Victorio Stock.
I just don't think it works. I can confirm it works. We're already using it with our patients.
The YouSound app is not free. It costs about $30 a year, but has customers already in some 150 countries. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition. Jamaican artist Omi has a song called Cheerleader that has quickly made its way to number one on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100 Singles chart. International Edition's David Byrd and Larry London chatted about the song and Omi's rise to pop stardom.
He's from Jamaica, and his hit is just burning up the charts. Omi. Larry, who is Omi?
Well, let me explain it to you, David. I'm glad you asked. Omi is Omar Samuel Paisley, and he's from Jamaica, as you mentioned. He has a special distinction. His record is the longest consecutive number one in the UK from a Jamaican artist in chart history in the UK.
More than Bob Marley.
That's right. 4 weeks consecutively number one on the charts. Right now, number two in the United States on the Billboard Hot 100, but it is the number one selling song in the United States, and it's called Cheerleader. And there are a lot of prognosticators who are predicting that this particular song will move to number one next week.
When I need motivation, my
one solution is my queen, cause she stays strong. Yeah, yeah. She is always in my corner, right there when I wanna. All these other girls are tempting, but I'm empty when you're gone. And they say, do you need me? Do you think I'm pretty? Do I make you feel like cheating? I'm like, no, not really, cause oh, I think that I found myself a cheerleader. She is always right there when I need her. That I found myself a cheerleader. She is always right there when I need her. She walks like a model. She grants my wishes like a
He's from Jamaica.
Yes, he is.
Is his style, do you think, does he borrow from some of his heritage? People like, you know, Bob Marley, Shabba Ranks, people like that. Or is he more on the kind of the John Legend end of that kind of smooth?
He's a
soul.
More modern time, modern day reggae sounding singer. He doesn't do it in the traditional Bob Marley vein, but reggae's got a certain distinctive style. And there's no mistaking the fact that this is a reggae song. And recently, I mean, here in the United States, we haven't been quick to embrace reggae songs. There have been few and, you know, not many, but recently it's Shaggy and Sean Paul and Magic a couple of years ago with a hit called Root. So this is the first time in several years that a reggae song has made it to almost the top. And as I say, many people think next week we're going to be saying this is the number one song.
Who does he list as his influences? Does he draw from other people, or is it just kind of, this is my thing?
This is his thing, and there are some, in fact, I was talking to Ray McDonald, who said that this is probably a one-hit wonder kind of guy, because we hadn't heard of him before. This is a song that he actually released originally in 2012, but now he's re-released it with Felix Jaehn, who's a very famous German producer. And so the song's been remixed and remade, and now, bang, it's near the top of the chart.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for that. That is OMI, and that's O-M-I.
O-M-I.
Okay. O-M-I. And if you have any questions or comments about OMI, or you want to hit Larry up on Twitter, that's at VOA underscore music. You can also watch Larry and listen to Larry do Border Crossings, his show where he has all kinds of people from the music and entertainment world come in. That's on www.voanews.com. Larry, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Burundi's controversial presidential election has been postponed until July 21st amid escalating violence there. Soldiers and unidentified gunmen clashed recently in Kayanza province, near the border with Rwanda. The governor there said the gunmen had crossed from Rwanda, a charge denied by Rwandan leaders, but which could fan fears that the political infighting and street protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza's running for re-election could escalate into a wider conflict. Burundi's opposition is boycotting the election, saying that Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term is unconstitutional. The announcement of his re-election bid in April triggered weeks of demonstrations, some deadly. The president cites a court ruling saying he can run again. Presidential spokesman Gervais Abayeho said Nkurunziza signed a decree postponing the voting, once scheduled for July 15th, in response to a request from the leaders of the East African Community partner states. The African nations had sought a delay until July 30th, to give Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni time to try to mediate a dialogue between President Nkurunziza and the opposing groups in an effort to restore peace and security. Abayeho said such a delay would be beyond constitutional limits. The United States is deeply concerned by reports that fighting has broken out in several areas of Burundi and by recently broadcast remarks by Burundians threatening to use force against their government. We urge all parties there to commit themselves to constructive dialogue to resolve peacefully the political impasse that threatens to unravel the peace and stability ushered in by the implementation of the Arusha Agreement over a decade ago. The United States condemns violence as a means to attain political goals and opposes any attempt to seize power through extra-constitutional means. We strongly oppose any armed activity or incursions into Burundi and will seek to hold accountable those responsible for gross human rights abuses.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.